Hello, hello. Welcome to the Shropshire Witches. I'm Alex.
And I'm Amy.
And we are thrilled because this evening we have a guest on the podcast who is, I think it's fair to say, a friend of the podcast, who has certainly been a long-term supporter. Well, in the short time that we've been going, Matt's been very helpful to us. But we have the wonderful historian, ally of Richard III, podcast host extraordinaire is the word I'm looking for. And it's Matt Lewis from History Hits Gone Medieval. So Matt, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So tonight we've got rather an interesting subject. So I'm going to sort of rather unfairly, but because you're very experienced, Matt, I'm going to pass to you just for a few moments because you know what we're going to talk about. So how would you, in a handful of words, describe what it is that we're going to discuss tonight?
Medieval monsters.
Yes, that's it.
Specifically, we can talk. We can talk ghosts. We can talk vampires. Mm-hmm. We can talk revenants, which is kind of zombies.
Yeah.
We can do some werewolves, if you like. We can do a bit of demon summoning. Demon summoning. We probably shouldn't do that. And kind of what, you know, what did these things mean to the medieval mind? Why were medieval people as interested in ghost stories as we are?
Okay. Oh, I love this. And Amy's looking thrilled as well. So we'll kind of just go straight into it. So I'm going to ask, and this isn't, I imagine, as exciting a question as Amy's going to ask, because, you know, Amy, this is very much your sort of area as well. But I'm always fascinated, this concept of ghosts, of monsters, how they sort of change through time. And one thing I do find really interesting is that problematic thing of the Reformation and what happens to ghosts once you become a Protestant country, which I know was a slow thing. But in terms of, I'm sorry if you can hear the dogs bark, we're just going to have to ride through this. But ghosts and monsters and warnings, a lot of these, I know, particularly monsters, come from sort of the 11th and 12th century. What happens to them after the Reformation? Do they continue to be something that sort of is moralistic tales? Like, what happens to them?
They do slightly disappear in that Protestantism is much less willing to be superstitious. So they accuse Catholics of being incredibly superstitious and bogged down in lots of things that they shouldn't concern themselves with theology. You know, they want to get rid of all of the paintings in the churches, and everything should be much plainer and much simpler. And Catholic, I guess what we might call Catholic superstition, goes along with that a little bit. So all of the saints have to go. You shouldn't be worshipping saints, really. You should be worshipping God and Jesus, and that's it. And along with that goes all of the things that are wrapped up with that spiritual superstition, however you might want to frame that. But this belief that there is this other realm, there is a bit in between heaven and earth where people can get a little bit stuck for a variety of reasons. And quite often the stories that we hear of these monsters, of ghosts and revenants and things like that, are souls who are trapped in purgatory and they're looking for help. So with the Reformation, purgatory is gone, so this idea that souls can get stuck is slightly lost as well, and the superstition that goes with it is sort of washed away and pushed to the side.
Okay, that's interesting. And do you think, so particularly some of these older stories, I imagine a lot of them were designed to be told aloud, basically, or as part of songs and oral storytelling. How do you think they would withstand to a sort of more modern audience with that in mind? Do you think they translate, or do you think they've sort of fallen into the realms of sort of fanciful, not nonsense, that seems unfair, but so sort of far-fetched? Do you think that they would still stand as spooky today?
I mean, some of them, if you look at some of the things in the Byland Abbey manuscript, they're scary. They're scary ghost stories. There is one in particular in there that is gruesome. You know, it's really hard to listen to. It's about a man who is away with some friends on business and things, and he has a vision one night of a whole load of spirits walking through the forest, and crawling at the back of this group of spirits is a baby that is sort of dragging itself along. It's wrapped in a sock, and he asks the baby who it is and why it's there, and the baby says, "I'm your son." And this man had left his wife at home pregnant. And so he gets home and finds out that his wife has lost the baby and also lost one of his socks. And, you know, when he found this baby, he had wrapped it in his shirt, and this baby had sprung to its feet and skipped off and run along with the rest of the spirits at that point. And the idea was that, you know, this child had said that it had died unbaptized and without a name. So he gives it a name, gives it some clothes, and it skips off to join the rest of the spirits rather than dragging itself along. So there's, you know, there's lots of moral layers to it, to all of these ghost stories. All of these stories have in the medieval world have lots of moral layers about, you know, the dangers of dying unbaptized or unconfessed and all of that kind of thing. But it's a hard story to listen to, that one is. And yeah, the way that these things are written down. So if you think of something like Beowulf, the possibly the most famous medieval manuscript story, we have one version of Beowulf that survived in a manuscript. And that's like, it's the Jurassic Park mosquito caught in the amber. That's the one that we have. But this is a story like these ghost stories that would have been told around fires on dark nights. And everyone would have added their own little twist. Everyone would have had their own little story. You change the names to make it sound a bit more local and a bit spookier, and maybe like it's someone you might know. So the stories that we have written down, the Byland Abbey manuscripts that story of the baby comes from, is a collection that was written around about 1400, so the beginning of the 15th century. It was discovered and popularised by M.R. James in the 1920s, the godfather James of the ghost story. He found this manuscript, translated it and compiled it. And these are local stories from near Byland in the north. And there is always this strong suggestion that these people almost experienced this. Lots of these stories are always someone told me, you know, man I know saw this, someone I know experienced this. It's always just secondhand. It's not quite someone's experience, but it's not too far away from them. And you get that sense from all these Byland manuscripts. And some of them are quite brief stories. They read like a set of facts, but what that is the skeleton of the story. What the storyteller gets to do is hang the clothes on it, put the flesh on it, the rotting flesh if they want to, and tell all of those stories in their own way. So what the Byland Abbey manuscript gives you, I think, is the bare bones of a set of ghost stories that you can go away and embellish and tell in your own particular way. You can add your own flourishes to them,
to whatever appeals, I suppose, because, you know, depending on the era, it's going to be era specific, isn't it? So like the Victorians being fixated with ghosts and things like this. So you'll find in that kind of era, there'll be certain things that they find creepy. I love that idea that you kind of mentioned there, that they had their own slant or people they know through somebody else or an area, because we still do that. You know, when everyone's telling ghost stories at primary school, and it's always like, oh, my cousin or someone when they went on holiday, or it's like spooky, weird things. So it's always fascinating, isn't it, how people don't ultimately change. And this fixation, I suppose, with ghost stories and the fascination with it as well. So I'm just going to ask one more question for, obviously, Amy, you're going to have lots of questions as well, so I'm not going to hog this, but was there a sort of era within, and I know, look, the medieval period is huge, I know this. So is there a specific sort of era where you see stylistically that these stories change, or the type of monsters, or maybe a certain era that is so synonymous with this type of horror? You know, the way that the Victorians are with spiritualism and things like that. Is there a century or an era that you would say, right, this defines them in terms of what they find spooky and how their stories are defined?
I think lots of what we have comes from, say, the 13th and 14th century. So the Byland Abbey manuscript is dated to around 1400, so at the end of that period. You've got things like Caesarius of Heisterbach is writing his Dialogue on Miracles around 1223. You know, this is a set of stories about how you deal with demons, how you summon them, why you need to be careful with them, what to do if it all goes horribly wrong. And there are stories, you know, either side of this as well. There's one medieval ghost story that is credited to Gregory the Great, who was Pope between 590 and 604. So we're getting right back to the 6th and early 7th century here. And Gregory the Great apparently used to tell a story about a priest he knew. It's always a priest, you know, isn't it? It's the same as the bloke down the pub now.
Case in point.
Priest that he knows that used to use a local baths to wash and clean himself, and whenever he arrived, the attendant would help him take his clothes and shoes off and help him in the bath. And after several visits, this priest thinks, so I ought to say thank you to this man, he's doing an awful lot for me to help me. So he takes two loaves of bread from the church and gives them to this man, and the man says to him, when he gives him the bread, why do you give me these, father? And he says, well, it's holy bread, and I can't eat it. My sins have meant that ever since I died I have to remain here. So the priest is like, whoa, hang on. He's been being helped every time he's visited the baths by the spirit of a dead man. The story says that the priest spent the next week praying for absolution for this man. And whenever he returned to the baths, he never saw this spirit again. So again, this locks into that idea that ghosts and medieval ghosts are often, most often, not hostile. Yeah. It's scary to encounter them. And you will quite often find in the stories that people are ill for several days after they've encountered a ghost. Mm. But these ghosts are rarely malevolent. What they're looking for is help. So this bath keeper in the late 6th century is trapped in the baths by his sins. And as soon as the priest prays for his absolution, he's able to make it out of purgatory and enter heaven. So there are lots of layers to these medieval ghost stories, but they come from very early in the medieval period, and they head all the way to the end of the 13th century.
That's so interesting. That feels very M.R. James as well. And I suppose it's a good advert for the church as well, isn't it? These sort of stories are like, you know, pay for people to sort of pray for your soul and things like this, and you won't end up like that bloke in the bathhouse. But Amy, sorry, I must stop kind of hogging with questions. I'm sure I'm going to be kind of chomping at the bit here with some questions.
So that leads really nicely into something I'd like to discuss a little bit. So I'm very interested in medieval religion, and I'd be interested to know your opinions on, when it comes to the supernatural, how do we discern from what we would now call supernatural events like ghosts, spirits, and then how would, in the medieval mind, the miraculous come into it? So what's the difference between something that is a miraculous event? You know, there's all sorts of wonderful thing in the hagiographies and stuff of female saints growing beards and things like that. And then what's the difference between something like that and a supernatural experience in the way we would see it today?
I think one of the difficult things for us to get to in the medieval mind is that there probably wasn't a very clear line between those two things, that religion required a belief in the supernatural. The part of the story with Revenants, you know, it's not hard for a medieval person to believe in zombies and the undead, because you're taught all of your life that Jesus comes back to life after 3 days in the grave. There is a weird kind of merging and blurring, and there's a reason that a lot of these stories are based in churches and tell the stories of priests, and they're all involved in it because there's some warning there that, you know, you should only handle these things if you know what you're doing. You need to be going through the church. Again, it's kind of focusing the power of the church in people's minds, that the church doesn't just have power over what we would consider to be religious things to do with God. It has really, it has power over these spirits and all of the things that go on between earth and heaven as well. And they serve to reinforce a lot of the church's teaching. You know, the church will teach that you should live a good life so that you don't commit the kind of sins that get you trapped in purgatory and forced to come back and wander forests until someone is willing to go and say some masses for you. Or in the case of some of these ghosts, they've stolen a set of silver spoons, so they'll find someone to go and give the spoons back for them so that they can be released. It's that idea that if you commit those kinds of sins, they will follow you. Mm-hmm. They don't end when you die. The punishment is longer than feeling guilty while you're alive. And that reinforces the church's teachings on that kind of thing. And it also, the fact that the living help the dead to navigate the afterlife reinforces the church's notions that you should pray for the souls of the dead to help ease their passage through purgatory. It's the reason that people, you know, rich, noble people will pay to have hundreds of masses said for their souls after they're dead. And that's because they've done a lot of bad things in most cases. And they can afford to have those sins eased by this process of saying masses. Lots of normal people can't afford to do that. But here is a reminder that you shouldn't forget those that are gone, that you can still help them by praying for their soul, by committing yourself to prayer. And it suits the church to have people praying all of the time.
Yeah. I think it's a very human thing as well, that I think even though the supernatural has changed in the modern society, we can look back and go, actually, that makes sense. That's that remembrance, and it ties into all that kind of thing. So it's really interesting. Another thing I'd be interested in discussing with yourself is, obviously, the medieval period is a very long period. And that's a news flash to all our listeners. The medieval period is long, using my history degree well there. And I'd be interested to see how maybe some of the archetypes in the supernatural changed through contact with other cultures, such as during the Crusades, and even things like trade, and even within like the Viking Age. Do we see that certain supernatural archetypes are brought into the country whilst this contact between different cultures and things happens? And how does that look within British supernatural kind of stories in the medieval period?
I mean, I think there are lots of things that are fairly universal. So ghosts crop up everywhere. Vampires are strikingly common. There are loads of stories of vampires in Eastern Europe during the medieval period. And you get these deviant burials of people who have been found in Eastern Europe, buried with heavy stones on their chest or with iron driven through their skull, through their bones, because people believed that vampires couldn't tolerate iron. Or they were, you know, manacled, their hands and wrists and their ankles are manacled together so that they can't get up and wander once they've been killed. There are cases where you find someone has had a ball of stone shoved into their mouth so hard that it's cracked their teeth. And this is obviously designed to stop them being able to get up and bite someone. So there's lots of queries about, you know, whether these burials meant that people genuinely believed in vampires, whether there was a bit of hysteria flowing around, whether there was just genuine concern that some people might be able to come back from the dead and come after you. And maybe if you'd upset them, you wouldn't want them to come back and come after you. But you also see those same stories happening in other parts of Europe. So, for example, there's one a collection of ghost stories that talks about a husband who caught his wife cheating on him, hiding in the rafters of his house. Catches his wife cheating on him, but he's so shocked and surprised that he falls out of the rafters, presumably on his wife and her lover. And he dies the next day of his injuries without having made confession. So every night then his corpse rises from the grave, wanders around the village, moaning and groaning, followed by a pack of dogs that howl at him. God. And people begin to die in the village. And they believe that it's a pestilence being caused by this wandering corpse. You know, they don't seem too bothered till they think, actually, that's a bit unhygienic. We ought to probably deal with the fact that there's a rotting body roaming around town. So two brothers whose father dies from this illness decide to dig the corpse up and burn it, because contemporary wisdom is that the best way to deal with these things is to exhume the corpse, burn it or dismember it, and stop it being able to come back. So they break the coffin open. The corpse is in there and they find it's distended. It's huge. It's grotesque. This guy has become hugely fat and he's really swollen. So they get an axe and start to try to dismember this corpse, and fresh blood just flows everywhere out of this corpse. And in this way, they realise that this isn't a pestilence that's been inflicted on the village. This guy was a vampire who was attacking people at night and draining all of their blood. So now they build this funeral pyre. They cut out the heart from the corpse and they burn the body, and no more villagers die after this. And that's much further west in Europe. So you get these kind of ubiquitous monsters everywhere. But then you do find ones sort of the Crusaders would have perhaps come into contact with notions of the jinn who are in the Near East, you know, these kind of magical beings. And that seems to be a step too far for Europe. Europe never really buys into this idea too much of magical spirits. They keep it firmly within the compass, and this is probably the Catholic Church in Europe with its grip. They keep it firmly within the realms of religion. There is a religious explanation for everything, and what they don't want is just magic that you can't explain by religion. So they must have come into contact with other things that don't make its way back into Europe, and yet there are these kind of more ubiquitous ideas that seem to be present all across Europe throughout the period.
That's fascinating, isn't it? And I suppose it translates in other things like you were saying there, and I was going to mention that with the Catholic Church. It's the same with sort of pagan things that then get eaten up by the church as well. They're like, how can we make this somehow more relevant to us so we can keep it, keep people happy, but also it's a little bit more relevant, maybe. One thing I do always find amusing is the sort of, and I think this goes throughout time, and to be honest, you could argue even with things like Uncanny on BBC Sounds that they cover so well is the hysteria. So like this chap's body, so they're like, right, take an axe to him, because I think that's the solution here. Yeah, they always do it. And in, you know, even when you look at things like, you know, bringing in priests and all this kind of stuff, and you only have to look on iPlayer now to see the programs that are about exorcism and things, and they sort of really bring a big audience in. So although we consider ourselves more advanced in a way, which I don't think we are really, we sort of remain very superstitious. And whether you believe in ghosts and all these sort of things, it's not that relevant really, because ultimately we just like to be spooked, don't we? I think that's what we're looking for.
I think if anything, we're probably more superstitious because we've managed to disconnect a lot of these things from religion.
Oh, that's
so medieval ghosts aren't scary because they're not coming after you to hurt you per se. They want to get your attention, maybe, because they want your help.
Yeah.
They want your assistance, and they might threaten you with, you know, there's one case of a story where a ghost says, you know, I need you to go and get priests, 10 good priests to say masses for me to save my soul. And if you don't do that, all your skin will fall off. But, you know, he's not necessarily attacking. He's just saying, I really want your help, please. Right. Otherwise something nasty is going to happen to you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously the guy goes and gets the prayer said.
You want your skin.
Want your skin to fall off.
I wouldn't risk it.
It's quite useful where it is.
Yeah, totally.
So, but today, you know, you watch a ghost story today, a horror movie about ghosts, and they are invariably malevolent spirits who are trying to cause people harm. And that is very different from a medieval ghost, because we've disconnected it from being in that transition from earth to heaven. And that it's no longer part of that process. We don't see it that way. We see it as it's something that shouldn't be there. It doesn't have a place in this world, and it wants to cause us harm. Medieval people simply didn't have that version of a ghost, really.
Yeah, because that's such an interesting slant, because you're under the umbrella of the Catholic Church. So although a lot of their tales are kind of moralistic and terrifying, like if you do this and you're not married or whatever it may be, or if you don't sort of pray for the dead, there's also that continuum of just sort of protection, isn't there? That these can't really hurt you because of this sort of all-seeing thing. I find it really fascinating. I want to go to vampires because this is not a subject I'm versed in at all. And because, like all, I was going to say all millennials, but really anybody, I think, born after Bram Stoker, to be honest, is just kind of has one idea of a vampire, which is this sort of super kind of sexed up, educated, I mean, eerie, yes, and sort of a little bit kind of gratuitously gothic, which is sort of not gratuitous because they're meant to be that gothic. But this idea of a vampire, as we perceive them now, if you instantly think of a vampire with the kind of the black hair, the very pale skin and all this sort of stuff, and usually very articulate, that's got to surely be a relatively modern invention. In terms of medieval vampires, educators, because until I sort of talked to you not long ago about this, I had no idea, in fact, that medieval people even thought about vampires. I thought this was much more of a kind of maybe 18th, 19th onwards century thing. So I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah, I think if you want to think medieval vampires, you are definitely not thinking Robert Pattinson. They are not sparkling.
Yeah,
they are not good-looking chaps who want to go to school and live a normal life. And I think that idea of the classic, more gothic, charming vampire that always has this allure to them, there's a sexual element to the vampire stories, really comes from the time of Bram Stoker.
Yeah.
And if you look at what Bram Stoker is writing about and the time that Bram Stoker is writing, it's a time when there is a lot of concern about immigration. I mean, you know, nothing really changes, does it? There is lots of concern about too many people coming into the country. We don't know where they're coming from. We don't understand these people. Bram Stoker's Dracula represents that. You know, he turns up at Whitby on a boat and he killed everybody on the boat, and we don't know anything about him, why he's here, what he wants to do. He's strangely seductive. People fall under his spell and they fall into his power and into his trap. And so there needs to be something charming. There needs to be a reason that these people are able to work their way into society and appear normal. So there's something quite xenophobic about Bram Stoker's Dracula. Medieval vampire stories, they're not everywhere. There's not tons and tons and tons of them. It tends to be a lot more archaeological evidence that you see of people who appear to possibly have been frightened of vampires.
That's fascinating.
But the stories that you do get, you know, like that one that I talked about of this corpse that they find bloated with blood, they tend to sound much more like zombie stories to us. The big difference between a zombie story and a vampire story in the medieval world is that the vampires will go back to their graves at the end of the night, and they will sleep and they will get up the next night and they will kill again. You know, zombies just wander aimlessly and want to dismember people. Vampires are kind of, I don't know, they're the next level of intelligence up from a zombie, maybe.
Yeah, you feel
they have a little bit of a purpose. So we need to be thinking less of the glamorous, seductive vampire and much more of the stinky zombie who just wants to bite you and go back to bed. But as I say, you know, there are skeletons that have been found in Poland with that rock jammed in its mouth and a wooden stake driven through its thigh. And again, this isn't the idea that a wooden stake through the heart will kill a vampire. It's pinning them into the grave. That particular corpse was also laid out so that the grave was facing east rather than facing west. So in Christian teaching, you have your grave facing to the west. So the idea is on the day of judgment, all of the bodies will sit up and they'll all face Jerusalem and face judgment. But this body is the other way around. So there's something about this person. They are not going to get to sit up on the day of judgment and face God. There are several other examples of skulls with these rocks jammed into their mouth, which suggests that they were concerned that people were going to get up and bite. So this idea that these are people who would come out of the grave, drink your blood, and then go back to bed and sleep it off. There are bodies that have had their legs cut off. Again, the idea being that they can't get up and wander if you've removed their legs. Large, you know, stones, big rocks placed on top of the grave. Coffins reinforced with iron bars, because again, vampires aren't supposed to be able to tolerate iron, so this will keep them within the grave. There is a skeleton from Bulgaria that dates to the 13th century, and this is a middle-aged man. I say middle-aged because he's my age. I'm going for middle-aged rather than old.
I'm not far behind, don't worry.
And he had like a 2-pound piece of iron that had been hammered through his chest hard enough to break his rib bones. And there are other examples of there's one in Bulgaria, which is known as the twin vampires of Sozopol. And these are from the 14th century, so just after that guy from Bulgaria. One of those has a piece of iron that looks like it's a piece of a plough, again, driven through his rib cage. So this is almost like in a frantic way, grabbing any bit of iron tool that you can find and breaking it off and hammering it into this body to keep it in the grave. And you have to wonder whether it was something specific about these people that made them think they were coming back, that they were terrible people in life. Maybe they were godless people in life that causes a genuine concern that they might come back from the grave. Or is this a community that is in a bit of hysteria because they're believing that bodies can come back? Perhaps there's been stories of people coming back from the grave, and as a precaution, they're taking all of these measures to pin bodies into the grave just in case. It's really hard to get at what is the fear behind causing people to do that. But it seems to me that if you're snapping off a bit of a plough and hammering it through someone's chest, you're pretty desperate and pretty scared of something.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I was going to ask you to what extent it's conjecture in terms of whether, I mean, because what seems obviously all of this is posthumous, but in terms of what's afflicted on the corpse. But it's interesting to me, exactly that point you just make, is whether these are people that are so wronged to such a degree that they felt they've had to do this, or whether they've kind of plucked at the last person buried in some sort of, I don't want to say vain hope, because I don't know what their fears were, that, you know, that so was this sort of fear, superstition, whatever it may be, that was affecting them, that they were like, right, the last person buried, let's do this. Because you could argue for both, couldn't you? Because there's something makeshift and frenzied about a bit of a plough, isn't there? Rather than, whereas you would think if it was somebody that had sort of wronged to such a degree, you would think there'd be something more planned, wouldn't you, than saying that they put Anne Boleyn in an arrow chest. So what, you know, it's just an interesting, I could see an argument for both that you could say.
And this goes back in time as well. So still in Eastern Europe, in Czechia, there is an 11th century graveyard that has thrown up 14 of what are suspected vampire burials in the same kind of graveyard. There's a mixture of men and women. They seem to be fairly young people. And there is a variety of things done to those bodies. So some have had their heads cut off. Some have had their feet tied together. Some have had big rocks placed on the bodies as if to hold them down. So, you know, was this some kind of epidemic of panic in Czechia at the time? But you can go back even further and you can bring it to Britain. So Nottinghamshire, in Southwell in Nottinghamshire, there is an Anglo-Saxon graveyard that dates from somewhere between the mid 6th century to the end of the 7th century. And there are 30 or so Christian burials in this graveyard aligned east-west, as I described. There's another section where a jumble of about a dozen skeletons were found, which were disarticulated. So just the random bones all sort of piled in. So perhaps a criminal pit or something like that, where people weren't in the proper burial rites. But then there is one skeleton outside the bounds of the graveyard that was buried around about the same time as all of the others. But it had iron nails hammered through its shoulder, hammered through its heart, and hammered through its ankles. And nobody quite knows why. What does that mean? Mm. You know, I'm not telling you that's a vampire burial because I don't know what people were thinking 1500 years ago. But it has all of the hallmarks of what will later become known as vampire burials. That idea that you need to keep someone in the grave. You need to stop them coming back and stop them being able to wander.
And I'm going to ask, sorry, Amy, I promise this is my last question for this bit. Do you think as we became sort of not like we stayed a non-secular society for so long, but I'm just interested, do you, because a lot of these sort of in later centuries, almost how they buried certain criminals and things at crossroads and that kind of thing. Do you think once we kind of maybe put aside the idea of monsters and vampires and things until Bram Stoker, do you think some of these ideas of what they used to do to criminals and things like that were taken from this? These kind of sort of burials, or do you think, I'm just interested because a lot of them seem to resonate with that kind of thing. Do you think just as we lost those superstitions, maybe we just thought for punishing people in general posthumously that we adopted a lot of these things?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, in the absence of evidence, we are in danger of assuming that these deviant burials are something to do with vampires and monsters and everything else. The other explanation that's possible is that these are criminals who are being punished. They're being denied a proper Christian burial as a form of punishment that goes beyond the grave. Perhaps what they had done was so heinous that it was decided, you know, you're not going to be allowed to rise on the day of judgment. And again, you know, hammering things to keep them in their grave may just be a way of stopping the body sitting up on the day of judgment and being able to get to heaven. It's so much more fun to think of them as vampires, really.
I agree. I think
I do.
Amy, I'm going to step back because I'm absolutely hogging this.
No.
It's so fascinating. But yeah,
it is, isn't it? I would be very interested to find out a little bit about where the devil sits in with the conversations of the supernatural in the medieval, because so much of when you get into the early modern period, things like witches and even to a certain extent ghosts and hauntings can be attributed to the devil or come from the devil. Is that something we see in the medieval period? And what is really the medieval relationship to the devil in kind of that more folkloric idea? So what's the devil all about in the medieval period?
He's pretty bad. It may not come as a huge surprise.
Wow.
He's not someone you want to be hanging around with. But it's not generally believed that the devil is in any way sending ghosts or anything like that. This is considered to be part of the transition between earth and heaven. You know, God is still in control of that bit of it. These people are in what medieval church teaching believed was purgatory. You know, Catholics still believe in purgatory. Protestants don't so much, but they were in this zone, and it's interesting how, you know, quite often the ghost stories are about a single person helping a ghost and resolving the issue that they have. You get to stuff like revenants and vampires and it's much more of a community effort. So there's all of these layers of the stories going on about, you know, how you deal with all of these things, but they're not necessarily considered to be evil. Medieval people, I mean, you know, the devil is definitely bad.
Yeah.
You don't particularly want to mess with the devil. But they do have a strange relationship with the ideas of demons.
Mm.
that have come out of hell, in that they are not afraid to talk about and to try summoning demons who they understand to be evil, okay, but who they believe that they can harness to do some good. It's that classic story of, you know, I can control this evil force so that I can just extract good from it. Some of those stories are around, there are believed to be certain summoning spells that will summon a demon who will grant you unlimited knowledge of everything in the world in an instant. You know, like the Matrix, they'll plug it in for you and you will immediately know everything. And so people clearly want to do that. But all of the teaching around this is that you shouldn't mess with this stuff if you don't understand it, that you need years and years and years of an education in all of this stuff to tinker with it. And the danger is if you don't know what you're doing and you start messing with all of this stuff. So I mentioned earlier Caesarius of Heisterbach. So he wrote this dialogue on miracles in 1223, and quite a lot of that is concerned with stories of demonic summoning. So he tells one story of a couple of necromancers, you know, as you do, hanging out.
You're in the right
Friday night.
Don't worry.
One of them eventually sort of falls ill, realizes that he's going to die, and so his friend says to him, you know, will you come back and tell me what it's like? You know, I'll summon you back from beyond the grave and you can tell me what it's all like. And the friend that's dying is like, yeah, sure. If I can do that, I'll come back. And on the 20th day, I'll come and visit you. And the story says that on the 20th day, the surviving friend is sitting in church in front of a statue of the Blessed Virgin, reading psalms for the souls of his friend. He's being a good boy. He's trying to ease his friend's soul through purgatory. And all of a sudden, his friend appears next to him, and it says his face is wretched, he's groaning with heartbreaking groans of torment and all of this kind of thing, and you know, weirdly the story says that his friend says, so how is it? It's like, is this not enough of a hint for you?
Don't know. Look, yeah.
And so the dead friend is like, this is awful. I'm eternally condemned. You know, I'm not even in purgatory. I'm eternally condemned because of the necromancy that we learnt together. And he says, for it's the true death of the soul, as its title shows. Mm. And so he says to his friend, you know, please, please, please give up all of this. Take up a religious life and commit your life to God in the hope that you can avoid the fate that I've suffered. And so the living man eventually, he enters the Cistercian order as a monk and spends the rest of his life serving God in the hopes that he can avoid his friend's fate. So there is this clear idea that messing with this stuff is a bad idea that can get you into a whole lot of trouble. And Caesarius tells us this other story of a clerk in Toledo who was good at summoning demons. His speciality, I don't know. Don't know if it's quite a party trick, but
it's quite neat.
And Caesarius says that, you know, I know a monk who went to visit this guy. So again, we've got that one step removal from this.
Yeah, of course.
The guy down the pub told me. And he says that this guy, you know, had a reputation for being able to summon demons, and lots of students came to him and they were like, can you show us, can you teach us how to do this? Can you give us a demonstration? And it says it's, you know, so that we may gain some result of our study. So they're looking for knowledge again from these demons to help them with their study. And this guy is really reluctant to do it. He's like, you know, it's a really bad idea. You don't want to do this. And they just beg him and beg him and beg him and mither him until he agrees to do it. So he tells them to meet him in this place in the countryside in the middle of the night. Weirdly, they all turn up. I mean, if someone told me to meet them in the countryside in the middle of the night, I'd probably say I'll leave it.
I wouldn't go. Amy would go. I wouldn't.
And so this guy draws a circle around all these students and he says to them, whatever you do, don't step out of this circle. Don't give anything to anyone who asks you for it. Don't take anything from anyone that offers it to you. Do not step out of this circle on pain of your life. And then he moves away from them a little bit and summons some demons with his incantations. And so they first turn up as this group of well-armed soldiers. They start, you know, practicing fighting around all of these youths who are marvelled by the appearance of all of these soldiers. They pretend to fall and they reach out their lances as if threatening the students, you know, trying to get them to lurch out of the circle perhaps, but none of them fall for it. So when this doesn't work, they turn into a group of beautiful women and they start dancing around all of these students. And you might be surprised to learn that this works a little bit better than the soldiers.
I'm shocked, honestly.
And the story says that the most beautiful one of the women reaches out to one of the scholars and holds out a gold ring to him. And this guy is clearly just getting very carried away with what's going on there. And so he stretches his finger out to allow her to put this gold ring on, but his finger goes beyond the circle. I mean, yeah, look.
Come
I agree
on.
With you, Alex. Stupid.
Yeah.
classic idiot.
Girls approve,
his finger goes outside the circle. This demon immediately howls with laughter, grabs him by his finger, drags him out of the circle and pulls him away to hell, and he disappears. And all of his friends are suddenly like, well, this isn't fun anymore, is it? And their response is not to think, well, he was an idiot. Their response is to tell this guy who summoned all of these demons that if he didn't get his friend back, they're going to kill him, because they don't want to have to explain to this guy's parents that he's been dragged to hell by a bunch of demons. And this guy is like, you know, it's not my fault. I told you what would happen. I told you to stay inside the circle. But he, you know, he's frightened enough that these guys are going to kill him to summon the demons back and say, can you let this guy go? You know, we've got a good working relationship going on here. You know, can you do me a bit of a favor?
Yeah.
I'm in a bit of trouble if this guy stays in hell. Can you just let him go?
Cut me a bit of slack.
And the demon who is described as the chief of the demons, you know, just the boss demon, says, well, what I'll do, I'll organize a trial for you. You pop down to hell tomorrow and we'll have a trial. You can give evidence at this trial. Someone will serve for the defense. Someone will serve for the prosecution. So they're frighteningly reasonable at this point, these demons. Weirdly undergoing a judicial process for the release of this soul. And so, this guy goes along to this demon court, and he pleads his case that this guy, he shouldn't have been taken. He was being a little bit silly, but you know, he only put the tiniest bit of his finger outside the ring and this demon snatched him away. And the judge demon, I mean, they have judge demons, I don't know. The judge demon says that, you know, the demon acted too precipitously in taking this soul and he shouldn't have done it. And he orders them to go and fetch this student, bring him back and release him. And they do. Again, it's frighteningly reasonable, isn't it? You know, I was a bit too quick to take that soul, so we'll give that one back. And apparently this guy, you know, goes back to all of his friends, tells them all what he'd seen while he was in hell, tells them that, you know, he's swearing off all of this stuff and he's going to live a good, God-fearing life for the rest of his days. And he becomes a monk in a monastery like everybody in all of these stories. So there is this moral element to it.
Yeah.
But it's weird how medieval people clearly had this idea that demons could be dealt with, could be reasoned with, could be trusted to hold, you know, a meaningful judicial inquiry into whether they had the right to take someone's soul. So again, they're not particularly evil for evil's sake.
Yeah.
They're willing to take the stupid who do things that they've been told not to do.
Yeah.
But they're also willing to let them off because they're just stupid young blokes, and stupid young blokes have always been stupid young blokes.
I love that. That's great.
I mean,
there's an interesting story as well about there's a guy called Gilles de Rais who
Gilles de Rais, we love Gilles de Rais on this podcast. Well, I know he's come from, you know, controversial.
It's difficult man to love, but part of the case, so Gilles de Rais, you know, possibly the earliest recorded mass murdering serial killer of children.
Makes us look good.
Accused of all sorts of wicked and terrible things. God. But amongst the charges that are laid before him are that in 1438, he employs an Italian priest to summon a demon for him called Baron. And Baron is one of those demons that can give you knowledge and power and riches. And so Gilles, you know, we're told Gilles has been selling lots of family lands. He's running out of money. And so he believes this demon is going to be the answer to all of his problems. And this Italian priest undergoes kind of three summonings to try and call this demon Baron, and they don't work. And the priest says, oh, you know, Baron's just really angry. And what he needs is parts of a child as a sacrifice, and then he'll come. And I presume that this Italian priest is thinking, well, you know, there's no way, you know, I've got away with it here. I've charged him for three summonings, told him why they've not worked, laughing all the way to the bank here. But Gilles de Rais turns up with a jar of bits of children.
Yeah, he's like, hold my pint, yeah.
And says, go on then, do it. And surprisingly, the summoning fails again. And at this point, Gilles, you know, rids himself of this Italian guy, but he's you know, left disillusioned, hugely out of pocket. And he'd been scammed. But there was this genuine belief that there were people who could not only summon demons, but who could control them and get them to deliver benefits. They weren't wholly evil beings, only capable of harm. You could extract something from them, but the danger was in messing with these things if you didn't know what you were doing.
Which kind of transfers, doesn't it? I also love the fact this demon was called Baron, and as is Donald Trump's son. So there's more a bit of irony there. But I also love, of course, in true classic style, that the man can repent. The rest of it. And of course, you know what is bad in that story that can't repent is the women, because they're what caused the problems. You're like, oh, isn't that the truth? It's fascinating to me. I love this idea that the one thing that can kind of deceive man, and they will kind of get the blame for that, and these men. And it's sort of giving a little bit of Persephone, isn't it, with her sort of pomegranate seeds and things like this. And, you know, don't step out of the circle. You think, well, I think I know what's going to happen here is someone, albeit just a finger, is going to sort of appear out of the circle. But of course, you know, people kind of disguise themselves as beautiful women. So, you know, they're fair. They had a good reason.
And even that is playing into the medieval church during this period. You know, so Caesarius is writing in the early 13th century. And this is the time when the church is really solidifying the idea that women are all daughters of Eve, that they can't be trusted with anything. They shouldn't have political power and authority because their entire purpose is to deceive men.
Of course. Yeah.
And these stories kind of reinforce that you know, the soldiers don't have any effect on these boys, but as soon as you put a group of beautiful women dancing around there, all of a sudden these boys go to pieces and are dragged down to hell by demons. That there is that level of institutional misogyny that the church is promoting built into a lot of these stories as well.
Yeah, that actually was still going on in World War II as well. So let's just, you know, let's not kind of think that it's a trope that sort of belongs in the ages. It's something that's gone on throughout as well. So one thing we've got to ask about, because this is never really a subject that I thought would be kind of my sort of area at all, apart from Oliver Reed playing a werewolf, of course, and anyone Todd that knows or follows me on any social media will know just how intense that obsession is. Werewolves, we've got to talk about werewolves, Matt. So go on, indulge us, because these are all things. I mean, look, I'm a big fan of Gone Medieval. In fact, I've got to say, and I'm not saying this because you're on here, it is my favourite podcast, and it was before we got you on as well. But there was an episode talking about werewolves a little while ago. And so when we sort of said, oh, we could bring that up as a subject, I was really pleased because I did not know that existed in medieval times. And I'd love you to talk about it, because there was a story as well about a wife, I think, who found out her husband was a werewolf. I think you can talk a bit about that if you would. It's a great story. There's some great names in it. And I think, would you indulge us and talk to us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll get to that story. It is a really fascinating one because it tells us one of the most interesting things about werewolves in that story.
Yeah.
So stories of werewolves exist kind of throughout the medieval period. Exactly what people believed is quite difficult to pin down, much like the vampires and those deviant burials. Mm. So there is an 11th century law code that was written by Canute when he was the King of England, the Danish Viking King of England, whose name I always have to read twice on a bookshelf.
Amy loves Canute. I love Canute.
She loves him.
The only person I love more is Harold. Hardrada.
We will stand Harold Hardrada on Gone Medieval all day long.
Amy's thrilled now.
King.
Yeah, so there is this 11th century law code by King Canute, in which there is one of the passages that says it seeks to ensure that the madly audacious werewolves do not too widely devastate nor bite too many of the spiritual flock. So there's an explicit use of the term werewolf there being prevented from biting Christians. What's not clear is what Canute understood a werewolf to be.
Okay.
The phrase that's used in the language that's used literally translates to wolfman.
Mm-hmm.
And it could mean an outlaw. So outlaws at this time were quite often called wolves. They go and live in the forest beyond the law of man. So it's difficult to say this is definitely evidence that Canute believed in lycanthropy, in werewolves as we would understand them today.
Mm.
But there are lots of stories of men who turn into wolves, werewolves, in medieval Ireland during this period. So Gerald of Wales wrote his topography of Ireland in the 12th century, around the time that Henry II is invading Ireland from England to try to colonise it. So the topography of Ireland is a really interesting piece, perhaps the first effort to justify colonialism and empire.
Mm.
It's a really interesting story. It paints the Irish in ways that stuck for centuries as wild drunkards, not to be trusted, barbarous. Gerald has a lot to answer for.
Yeah.
But amongst his stories, he talks about a monk in Ossory who encountered the friendliest werewolf you could ever hope to meet in your life and had lots of conversations with this werewolf. And the werewolf eventually pleaded with the monk to go and read last rites to his dying wife. And the monk agrees to go along to the werewolf's home. And the wolf explains on the way that they've been cursed to spend 7 years in animal form. So he and his wife have to be wolves for 7 years. And then at the end of that 7 years, they could return to their human state and the curse will pass on to somebody else. Mm. So it's almost like this movable, temporary experience of having to live as a wolf. There's an 11th century Irish poem that says these monsters exist partly, it was believed, because they'd been cursed by St. Patrick during his conversion of Ireland to Christianity. And it says that there are people within Ireland who can turn themselves into the form of a wolf, and they will rend flesh with wicked teeth, and they're often seen slaying sheep that moan with pain. But when men raise the hue and cry or scare them with staves and swords, they take flight like true wolves and they disappear. There is a 13th century Norwegian text known as the King's Mirror. And this is partly lessons on how to be a prince and a nobleman and things like that. But this tells stories of Irish werewolves. So Norwegians know about Irish werewolves. And this same idea of a curse that passes through generations of a family. So rather than moving on to different couples, in the Norwegian tale, it's passed through generations. Gervase of Tilbury writes around a similar period to this in the 13th century that werewolf stories shouldn't be dismissed because in England, we've often seen men change into wolves.
Mm.
Have you, Gervase? Really? Have you?
Got a question for you, Gervase.
After a good night down the pub.
Yeah.
There are stories that go back to the 11th century of Scandinavian werewolves. When the Vikings are settling in the Kievan Rus area, so the area that is now Kiev, Ukraine, and sort of Western Russia, there is a Belarusian leader who is believed to have been a werewolf, and he roamed around at night killing people, and in the day he ruled like a normal nobleman.
Mm.
There is a 14th century source by a writer named Johannes Actuarius, and he describes the condition of lycanthropy, and he says it's a form of melancholy.
Okay.
That makes the affected person wander around at night, and he says they often visit tombs, and they wander around like wolves, and they come back in the morning as their human selves, and they stay at home all day. And he said these people will often have ulcerated legs and sore feet because they wander around on stones and thorny ground all night. They'll have like dry eyes and a dry tongue, and their vision will be poor from the time they spend as a wolf. He said some patients that he's treated, he claims he's treated people with lycanthropy. He says some of his patients fear dying as a result of this condition, and others hope that they will die. So there are lots of different potential explanations for this. So there are, again, more Norwegian sagas and stories that talk about a group of people called the Ulfhednar, Ulfhednar. My Norwegian is not great.
Mine, yeah.
So we quite often hear of Viking kind of berserkers, and berserkers are associated with bears. So they wear bear pelts and they behave like wild bears.
Hmm.
The Ulfhednar were said to have the characteristics on a battlefield of a wolf, that they were impervious to pain, they would fight, and they would wear wolf pelts and wolf heads because the wolf is closely associated with Odin in Norse mythology.
Mm-hmm.
So whether the idea that you could get these ferocious warriors running onto a battlefield wearing a wolf pelt, perhaps with a wolf head, whether that lies behind the idea that you see in lots of medieval manuscripts that there was a race of doghead people out there mm-hmm. somewhere, or whether this is the root of the idea of werewolves, that people would tell stories of men wearing a wolf pelt who seem to transform into the ferocity okay. of a real wolf, and somehow that becomes lycanthropy and werewolves as we understand it is again, it's really hard to get at, but it sounds like medieval people believed in werewolves. And that story that you mentioned that I'm, yeah. I promise I'm going to get to.
No, because honestly, this is fascinating. Keep going, please.
I'm waffling on werewolves.
No, you're not. No, I love it.
So this comes from the 12th century. So we're in the 1100s here, and it comes from the lays of Marie de France. So this is a French lady who writes these stories and poems. And this is the story of a knight named Bisclavaret. He lives in Brittany. He is a well-respected knight, a handsome man of noble lineage, and he's married to a beautiful noble woman. So far, so good. Starts yeah. like all the stories.
Excellent.
Handsome knight, beautiful noble woman. Every month, Bisclavaret would disappear for 3 days, and nobody quite knew where he was going or what he did. And one day, eventually, his wife kind of decides she's going to broach the subject with him. And she says, you know, where do you go and what do you do? And he doesn't want to tell her. He, you know, desperately tries not to explain what's going on. And she starts saying, you know, have you got another woman somewhere? You know, should I be worried that you're having an affair when you go off and disappear for these 3 days? And this eventually causes him to admit that for 3 days of every month, he transforms into a wolf and he has to go and hunt in the forest. And he says to his wife that there's a chapel just on the edge of the forest, and he hides all of his clothes in a boulder under there just before he transforms, and that he needs those clothes to be able to transform back into his human form at the end of the 3 days. And you might like to think that his wife would be understanding of this. She is not. She does not like this.
Okay.
She is shocked. She's probably scared, I'd imagine. And she desperately decides she wants out of this marriage. She does not want to be married to a werewolf. She gets in contact with another local knight, a guy who she knows has a bit of a crush on her. And so she says to him, you know, my husband's a werewolf. Do you fancy killing him for me?
Classic.
As you do, you know, the way to start a conversation, come round for a drink. Husband's a werewolf. Would you like to bump him off for me?
You'd have to be quite attracted to that sentence, I think. Yeah.
And so what they decide to do eventually is to follow him on the day that he's disappearing. And they find this boulder outside the church where he hides his clothes. And this knight steals Bisclavaret's clothes. So that when he returns to the chapel at the end of the 3 days, his clothes aren't there. He can't return to his human form. He's trapped as a wolf. And the story continues that a year later, the king of France, this is in Brittany, so it'd be the king of France, is hunting in the forest, and his hounds chase down this wolf. They corner this wolf, and the hunting party turn up as the dogs are baying around this wolf. And the wolf manages to break away from the hounds and runs over to the king and starts making a huge fuss of the king. And the king is absolutely amazed. This is weird. This wild wolf has come over for a bit of fuss. But as I think I would, probably thinks actually this is quite cool.
Yeah.
Who doesn't want a pet wolf?
Name him.
And so he says, you know, he calls off the dogs, and the wolf follows him home, and it becomes the king's beloved pet. And, you know, mm-hmm. everybody is amazed that the king has this wolf wandering around his home. It sleeps with members of the household, is completely placid. One day, the king puts on a feast, and the knight who had stolen Bisclavaret's clothes is now married to Bisclavaret's wife,
mm-hmm.
presuming everybody believed that Bisclavaret had been killed or disappeared. And the couple turn up for this feast, and the wolf attacks the knight And everyone in the room is utterly amazed because this wolf has never, ever gone for anybody before. And later on, the king goes out to the forest to hunt again, takes the wolf with him. As you do, if I had a pet wolf, it would go everywhere.
Yeah, everywhere. Exactly. Yeah.
And while he's there, Biscravray's wife comes to see the king to do homage. I don't know if she's got another husband that needs bumping off, but maybe. But the wolf sees this wife and it attacks her so savagely that it bites her nose off. And the king is now thinking, well, I can't have this. This is not on. But one of his advisors says, hang on a minute. This wolf has never, ever been violent or shown aggression to anybody except this woman and her husband. Mm. He says, we also know that this woman's first husband disappeared several years before. And this advisor says, you know, I'm wondering whether there's a connection somewhere between this. I don't imagine they're thinking this is a werewolf.
Yeah.
But maybe this wolf knows, you know, this wolf was
something.
Knew Biscravray or something. I don't know. And so this advisor urges the king to question the woman and her husband before doing anything about the wolf. And I mean, they torture the woman.
Of course they do.
Because it's a medieval story. Of course you torture the woman.
Not the man, the woman though, yeah.
And surprise, surprise, under torture, she admits everything that she did. And so the king orders her to go and fetch Biscravray's clothes that they stole from that chapel. And she goes and gets them and brings them. And the king shuts the wolf in a room with these clothing, gives it a bit of time. I don't know how long, but at some point...
I'm going to ask you how long.
At some point, he opens the door to the room, I imagine quite slowly, to find Biscravray sitting there in his clothes.
Yeah.
And his wife and her husband are sent into exile for what they did to Biscravray. And no action is taken against Biscravray for being a werewolf. No one is bothered. You know, hurrah, Biscravray's back as a human. That's great. Mm. The interesting thing I think about this werewolf story is that the werewolf is our protagonist. The werewolf is the one we're feeling sorry for. Mm. He's the one who's hard done to. You know, he turns into a wild animal and goes hunting in the forest for 3 nights a year. But it's his wife and this other guy who are the awful ones. He's the victim. And it's weird, I guess, that we find a story in which the monster is the victim. There's a little bit of Frankenstein going on there, but this is, you know, in the 1100s. This is 700 years before Frankenstein. You are driven to feel sorry for the monster of the story.
Mm. It's a little bit like Bed Gellert, though, isn't it, as well? So you kind of have that sort of idea of the dog, you know, as a kind of follow-up from that. You sort of feel sorry for them. I also have kind of quite childish notions when you said, like, presumably after a while of knocking and being like, are you decent? I mean, like, what are you going to find in that room?
Well, what's the protocol? You know, how long do you leave a werewolf in the room with its clothes before you go back in and see if he's human again? I don't know.
There is one. You can't kind of walk in and be like, you know, I'm covering my eyes for anyone that can only hear, not see us. But yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? I think I'm also not overly surprised by the sort of the Irish association, because of course, I'm thinking of everyone listening, forgive my pronunciation, things like Cor Cullen, but who was the one, wasn't there one that turned into a raven, and there was the swans and all this sort of thing? So they had quite a long history, didn't they, within sort of transforming into animals and things like this. So maybe it's sort of fascinating to me that the Irish have this history of kind of transformation. So maybe not overly surprising that they have a kind of a werewolf culture. I didn't know that they did. So it is really interesting. But I suppose with the old Irish myths and things, they do love somebody to turn into a raven or various birds and things. I can't remember the swan story, but I think it was the...
That's partly playing into Gerald of Wales's work, you know, his idea that the Anglo-Normans were there to Christianize and, you know, in scare quotes, to civilize these people. So you need them to be somehow disconnected from Christianity. I mean, Ireland was Christian before Britain was, before England
was. I didn't know that. That's okay.
Celtic Christianity had remained detached from the Roman Church. And part of what Henry II does is this is kind of after the murder of Thomas Becket. Mm. And part of what Henry II is doing is saying to the Pope, I'll go over there and spread Roman Catholicism to Ireland if you let me off.
Okay.
He also says, I didn't do it, but if you let me off, I'll go make them Roman Catholic. So there is this effort to portray the Irish as somehow disconnected from Christianity, even though their brand of Christianity is older than the English brand of Christianity. You know, lots of Celtic Christianity is imported to the north of England, in particular during the medieval period. It just loses out to Roman Christianity eventually, particularly after the Synod of Whitby. But there's this idea that you have to paint the Irish as needing to be civilized. They have to be slightly wild and monstrous. And so they get wrapped up in all of these stories that they can, you know, commune with animals and transform to animals, and they spend time living as wolves or ravens or whatever else it is. That there is something magical and dangerously non-Christian about the Christians of Ireland.
Yeah, that's because I didn't.
Sorry, any Irish people? not what I think
no,
at all.
It's not our views.
If anything, they've kind of maintained this idea of being quite sort of elusive and ever kind of appealing in that way. And I suppose I didn't realise that about Christianity, because of course we think of like Chéan an Óg and all these things and these Irish myths that they're, do you know what, absolutely, and it sounds very patronising, but they're so well versed in their folklore and their heritage in that way that actually I'm going to say the British, I mean, we're not in the same way, because obviously you are, Matt, because you're a medieval historian, it's very much your area, but you know, I'm going to say that everyday people that, you know, which, you know, certainly I am, talking about this kind of thing, we don't know all that much about it, and it's extraordinary. Whereas in Ireland, they're very well versed, I think, from songs, all sorts. There's all these kind of ancient literary references and things that they just all totally get, because their folklore is alive and well, which I find really sort of enviable in a way. And I think Scotland and Wales likewise, and maybe English folklore has kind of taken a, not a backseat, but is not preserved perhaps the way that it is in France and other places. But Amy, as we kind of sort of draw to a close, you must have some questions, because I've absolutely hogged Matt, and I apologise, because I saw your face as well, Canute and Gerald of Wales. I thought you must be one of the only people apart from maybe Matt that smiled when someone said, was it Gerald of Wales? And your face, you just smiled and you looked thrilled. I thought, this is your era. But go on, I'm going to step back, because you've obviously got some questions.
I think Canute and Gerald of Wales would be a whole different podcast. We could just talk about that. Now I know that you're a Hardrada fan. I think that should be a whole spin-off. Is just
reasons
why Hardrada is amazing. No, but I think we've had a really good exploration of the medieval mind when it comes to the supernatural. But I would be interested just to find out if there's any other kind of branches of the supernatural, or kind of folkloric creatures or folkloric characters in kind of inverted commas that are quite prevalent in the medieval world, or kind of even things like the fairies and goblins and things like that. How do they fit in to kind of the grand scheme of things when it comes to the medieval era?
I think those ideas of kind of fairies and goblins and things like that are much less prevalent during the medieval period. I think I don't come across them anywhere near as much as you do, particularly ghost stories. And I wonder whether that is because ghost stories, you know, what the early Catholic Church, what the early Christian Church is really good at is absorbing and transforming customs, folklore, stories. You know, Christmas is only on December the 25th because it's a pagan festival anyway. They were, the Christianity really grows out of the Roman Empire, and what the Roman Empire was really good at was moulding itself around the people that it wanted to rule. It was willing to accept their ways of life and just rebrand it slightly as Roman. And I think the early Christian church is also very, very good at that. So all of the things that they can wrap up with God, and ghosts fit perfectly. It's a spirit that has left the body and hasn't quite made it to heaven. Perfect, we can work with that. Things like fairies and goblins become much more difficult because they're not human creatures. Now, these, with the exception of demons, the things that we've talked about are humans who are in some way stuck or need help or are cursed, in the case of werewolves perhaps. But they're all humans and they have a human soul. I think they try to shy away from things like fairies and goblins that aren't human, that don't have a place in the Christian kind of story of humans and the soul and the transition from earth to heaven, the dangers of hell. They sort of don't fit, so I think they get squeezed out a little bit from the stories, and you see much more of the ghosts, the revenants, the werewolves.
That's really,
does that make sense?
Yeah. It's really interesting as well, because folklorically, at least within kind of Shropshire's context, there's a real grey area between what's conceived and thought of as like a goblin or even the fae and the devil and demons. They all seem to merge into this kind of entity that is the devil, who can, and even the way we describe the devil in Shropshire folklore is things like the devil haunts an area. You only really see that in folklore. You would never say that in a Christian context that the devil haunts something. So it's very interesting to see the much, much later stories, which kind of, because a lot of Shropshire's folklore comes from kind of arguably late 1600s through to the 1800s, how that can have its origins or influence in the medieval period. So it's interesting to think about things like that.
It's also interesting that it then in the 16th, the 18th century, it comes after that disconnection from the Catholic Church again. Yeah. So the removal of all of that belief and what we might call Catholic superstition about spirits and ghosts, you disconnect that and suddenly you can have those magical creatures again, and they can begin to make their way back in, which shows, I guess, that, you know, they've never disappeared. They've never entirely gone. Mm-hmm. And you guys will know this better than me, but they must survive at a local level in stories that are told everywhere. They're just not, maybe in a Catholic Christian country, it's not the done thing to broadcast them too widely. You know, yes, tell them round the fire, but let's not write this one down too much.
But then it's interesting as well, because they also appear in misericords and poppy heads and things like that. So there's some poppy heads near us, which sort of depict the story of Mitchell's Fold and that kind of thing. So it's interesting, whilst, I mean, they're 19th century, so they love that kind of thing. But some of the misericords in places like Montgomery, they kind of show some quite graphic imagery that may be washed in medieval times, because they kind of, you know, they were slightly more tongue-in-cheek about it. But definitely after the Reformation, I think we're a bit like, no, don't look at that. You know, but medieval
we're
times,
British.
Like, yeah, there's kind of like, you know, guys doing various things. And they're like, yeah. And I love that just the clergy see it as well. And I suppose it's a little bit like the Robin Hood thing that I'm so fascinated by, which is always that, of course, after the Reformation, they're like, how do we explain the guy living in the woods that's obsessed with the Virgin Mary? Because that's got to change. Like, you can't really, it doesn't sit in the same way, does it? So we're like, I don't know, let's give him Marion. And then it turns out she's an old French reference anyway. So we're kind of borrowing from everyone. But I just love that as the eras change, you've got to kind of slightly alter the stories, be they monsters, you know, outlaws, whatever it may be. They all kind of take different guises, but they've got to fit generally whatever the kind of ecclesiastical theme is of that moment.
Yeah. And I think part of the beauty of all of these stories, as we've discussed, you know, quite often what we have set down is that shell of a story. Mm. It's for you to wrap it up in whatever you want to wrap it up in. And that will be relevant to wherever you are and whenever you are. And that story can change. I always think it's a lot like if you go and watch a comedian do a stand-up routine. Mm. You know, if they come to your local town, they will make all of their jokes about the next town along that you hate. And then when they go to that town, they'll make the jokes about your town. You know, and I think medieval stories are a lot like that. You know, you would turn up in Wolverhampton and talk about how awful the people of West Bromwich are.
Yeah,
that's just what you do. And then you go to West Brom and say the people in Wolverhampton are absolutely awful. Mm. And I think these stories do the same thing. So you get that shell of a story, but you can hang on that whatever you want, a local place that people will know that might make it a little bit spookier because it's close to home. The name of a local person who might be quite well known that you can tip in there and suggest that it might be this person that's up to no good. It's a local wood that all of this spooky stuff happens in, that can change all of the time.
Yeah.
And as you say, it can evolve, and it's the stories are all organic things that are designed to play on whatever will spook us the most right now.
Yeah. I think that's wonderful. And of course, you know, they always do it. They say American comedians change things for British people because we don't know half the people they're talking about. Or of course, the Great Divide, which is Shrewsbury and Telford. Or they do the South Shropshire, North Shropshire. Amy's a Telford girl and I'm South Shropshire.
I was going to say, Alex, we're going to fall out here.
They always do that. Everyone from South Shropshire is posh and then Telford's like, you know, so they always do the same joke and we're well versed in it as well. But look, Matt, it's been an absolute joy. I mean, the time has flown, certainly for us, so hopefully for you as well. I hope that you'll come back on for different subjects, because I've got three of your books downstairs. So I meant to add at the beginning when I sort of fumbled over my words that Matt is also an author, and it's well worth reading. So particularly I've read your Richard the Third book, which is, for those that can't see, is behind Matt, but I've got that and I've read it and it's fabulous. And I think it's a really interesting view on one that sort of, it's changed in recent times, hasn't it? I know that's for a different podcast, but I just think it's worth looking into. So I hope you'll join us to talk about Eleanor of Aquitaine and Richard III and various things. You'll be on more than you care to be, I think, if you are. I mean,
if you say Eleanor of Aquitaine and Richard III, I will be back anytime. There are names that will summon me to the podcast.
Those are
just a couple of them.
I've got a list of questions that I'll have to ask you at some point, because my partner's a medievalist. I'm an early medievalist. I like the early medieval, but he's kind of Henry II's his guy. So he was like, oh, if you have a chance, ask this. And I was like, we won't, but that's for another one. So
Callum, we'll get Matt back on, because that is going to be Callum's ear, isn't it? We're going to be like, he's sitting there going, how can you not have asked this? And we'll get, it wasn't relevant tonight, but we promise. Yeah. Matt, thank you so, so much. We've absolutely loved it. And who knew all this about the medieval era? It's amazing. Thank you. And please, for all our listeners, listen to Gone Medieval, if you as if you don't already, but it's a fantastic podcast. It's just every episode is completely different. It's twice a week, isn't it? Is it Thursday?
Tuesday and Friday.
That's it.
And then Yarniger's episodes on a Tuesday and mine on a Friday.
You're on the Friday. Yeah. It's ace. Give it a listen. It's so varied. It's fascinating. And they talked about Missouri Quarter recently, which I was very, very excited about as well. So, please listen in. Matt, thank you so much. And we'll see you all soon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.